Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Former executive director of the Pegasus Institute and now working on a new and exciting project, which hopefully we'll be able to tell you about more of soon, is Jordan Harris. How are you, man? It's good to talk to you again, buddy.
I'm doing well, all things considered. How are you, Leland?
I'm great. And I know I can't drag out of you what that big special project is just yet, can I? I can beat you over the head about it, but I just can't. I can't get you to admit it yet, huh? But it's going to be exciting.
Not just yet, but people are going to love it.
Yes.
And it is very exciting. And we are chomping at the bit to be able to announce what we've been working on for the last 6 months or so. And soon enough, we will go public. And I can't wait until we do, but not quite yet.
Awesome. Well, we'll just ring you up again when the time comes.
Absolutely.
Okay. I wanted to get into a couple of things because you formerly were the executive director of the Pegasus Institute, and that organization has been doing a terrific job of keeping Kentuckians updated with all sorts of information. Let me start with this one, the latest blog that they put up. Tennessee has tested three times as many residents as Kentucky and has 40% fewer deaths than the state per capita. I want to dive into why that is, why that's significant, and let me just start it off with the fact that when you are listening to this podcast, it'll be a couple of days ago by then, but as we are recording today, the governor said, hey, you know what, we're going to have testing of about 20,000 people a week, hopefully in the next few weeks, and we're about to announce a new partner to do tests. We're going to focus on first responders, but we're going to get more tests done and it will be more open to the public, meaning just about anybody, instead of those strict parameters. What is he feeling the pressure from other states that are doing a better job of sampling their public?
I think that he has to be. I mean, the numbers are really, really bad for Kentucky. And I think that some of those restrictions that have been in place are part of the reason that they've been so bad. So to kind of frame exactly where Kentucky stands, you know, among our neighbors, one of the things that makes it really good for data collection in Kentucky is because there are seven border states around us that we can get a decent sample size. And among our border states, with us included, we are second to last in tests per capita. And Tennessee, which Kentucky always likes to compare itself to Tennessee, to our south, has done three times more tests overall and is doing more than twice as many per capita. They're doing over 150 per 10,000 residents. Kentucky's only at 74 tests per 10,000 residents. And one of the things that's so key in Tennessee is that they have just opened up 33 new drive-through facilities where you can go through if you just want to know. You don't even have to exhibit symptoms. You just want to know whether or not you are carrying the virus or not. And you can go through one of those drive-through testing facilities and get tested. Kentucky still has requirements in place, symptoms that have to be met, approval that has to be met, and only has four drive-through facilities, all of which you have to sign up for ahead of time and meet those requirements to be able to get tested. And so the number of tests between our state and Tennessee is abysmal. And for a state that we've pointed to throughout this entire process, and that the Beshear administration has tried to point to and compare itself to through this entire process, the data with 5 weeks now into this, Tennessee is completely stomping us in this particular area. And so I do think they're starting to feel the pressure. And the other thing that's key is that for us to be able to get out of this thing, we're going to have to be able to do testing at a wide capacity. I mean, I think that's universally agreed upon. We are still a little bit in the blind right now, not just in Kentucky, but nationally. There are two types of tests that are going to be incredibly important for us. One is the test to see who the current carriers are. And there is increasing evidence every day that there's a much higher percentage of the public that's carrying the virus than are symptomatic or that we're aware of. And then the second is the antibody test, which tests who's already had it. And if we're going to be able to get back to a place where we have college football, which please God, let us have college football.
Yeah.
If we're going to get to a place where we're going to be able to all pack into stadiums, I went to Penn State undergrad and I want to be in Beaver Stadium this fall. We're going to have to be able to do the testing to know who's been a carrier, who has the antibodies already, and really what the picture is on the ground. And if that's going to be the case in Kentucky, we're going to have to do much, much better. And the buck stops with the governor
right.
on this.
Right.
It absolutely does.
What is Tennessee doing differently than Kentucky is? Were they not as shut down? Did they leave some businesses open? I know they moved to open their economy quicker than Kentucky has. I think they're planning to reopen completely, or at least maybe in stages, but they're planning to get started back to business on May 1st.
That's right.
I still don't have a direct idea of when Kentucky, maybe they, I didn't get a chance to listen yesterday to the governor's, whatever that is, press conference or, Uncle Andy's hour or whatever it is, but,
right.
I still don't have a firm date on when they think they want to open up the Bluegrass State. So what did Tennessee or has Tennessee done significantly different besides the testing?
Yeah, the state of Kentucky refuses to give a firm date or refuses to even entertain the prospect of a target date, and has only in the last few days even given us a little bit of a picture of the criteria that they're going to use to reopen. And they've put in place a much more strict criteria than the White House. Tennessee, to your point, was not as restrictive on the economic side to begin with. Something that frankly the Beshear administration was extremely critical of. You may remember that very early on, members of the Beshear administration said that our neighbor to the south was acting reckless.
Right.
And very early on, even before he filed an official executive order that barred Kentuckians from going to other states, which is still in place for the state of Kentucky. If you go to another state, you have to quarantine for 14 days. But even before he did that officially through executive order, he encouraged Kentuckians not to go to Tennessee because they were being, quote, reckless. Well, not only were they slower to put in those economic restrictions, but now they've given an official target date and of when they're going to reopen. And in this intervening 5-week period, all of their data has been much more positive. And so a pretty heavy accusation to levy against a neighboring state to say that they're not doing enough, basically, to take care of their citizens, so much so that you encourage your own citizens not to go to that state. But there is absolutely no data, frankly, that reinforces that what Tennessee's did strategically with their own economy or is planning to do moving forward with their economy is reckless or any worse than any other state in the region. And there's significant data to suggest that they're doing a whole lot better than us, and they're probably going to do a whole lot better from a job than us from an economic standpoint coming out of this because of that. And one of the key factors overall is the number of deaths and the number of hospitalizations.
Right.
And with the number of deaths, Tennessee has 2.4 approximately, we'll know for sure after this census, but approximately 2.4 million more people than the state of Kentucky, and has in total fewer deaths.
Almost half the number of deaths per 100,000 as well.
Absolutely. So doing incredibly better on the death standpoint. And some people have tried to point to this and said that health outcomes are superior in Tennessee, and so that this is the reason. Look, I think it's too early, really, to judge exactly what caused that discrepancy between deaths in Kentucky and deaths in Tennessee. The only thing that we can do at this juncture is to say that the thesis that Tennessee acted recklessly and endangered their citizens and would be an endangerment for Kentucky citizens to go there is totally unfounded.
Yeah.
We certainly have enough data at this point to say that was an unfair thing to be levied by our administration here in Kentucky onto the Tennessee administration. We'll have 10 years to evaluate some of these factors and figure out why was it that Kentucky's death rate was higher
right.
than Tennessee's, or why is it that Kentucky's death rate is higher than West Virginia. We'll have 10 years to evaluate that. But in the short term, I think what we can say definitively is that the sort of fear mongering about Tennessee not doing a good enough job at this hasn't come to fruition.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's, again, I want to go back to literally half the death rate per 100,000, half the death rate per capita, and our governor was telling us not to go to, maybe Tennessee did better because we didn't go down there. I don't know. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, but, you know, I've been talking to doctors and data hounds, and the more I look at this, you know, there was one of those little, what do you call those graphs where the circles cross each other? I forget the name of the graph, but something.
Yeah.
Shoot. Now we're both not going to be able to. Venn diagram.
Yeah.
I was like, God, we were both educated. What's wrong?
Right.
With you? I posted a Venn diagram from a friend of mine on Facebook today that was, you know, it showed the three circles. One was totally concerned about the coronavirus, taking it seriously. The other was very worried about the economy. And the other was worried about essentially authoritarian impulses of government. The three circles intersect in the middle, and there's me right there. And the point I'm making is that the mark of intelligence is being able to hold to what seem like, at least on the surface, opposing views at the same time. It's not quite that, but it kind of is, at least the way the media paints it, that if you are talking at all about reopening the economy, then you want people to die. And that's just not the case. And
right. There's
more and more evidence showing that we might have been just fine as a nation from the beginning to just go, hey, everybody put on a mask, stay 6 feet apart. Really? That might be that needed to happen.
I totally agree. I mean, I look at this data constantly myself too, and I just wonder how much two factors played a role in our reaction and kind of forced our hand on which strategy we were going to take. Because look, here's the thing about the social distancing as a process of alleviating this is a theory.
Right.
It's not proven. And right. And that doesn't mean that it's wrong. Don't, I mean, people shouldn't misunderstand what I'm saying, but they should understand that it's still open to scientific scrutiny and academic scrutiny. It's a theory. And so essentially we followed this pattern based on a single data point. And that single data point was the Philadelphia versus St. Louis comparison from the 1918 second wave of the Spanish flu. It really is unclear at this juncture whether or not that was necessary for coronavirus. It could have been. It very well could have been. And I totally support the actions of governors in March to shut down, to prevent large gatherings from taking place so that we could get more data. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we need from our leaders moving forward is adaptability. We have more evidence now. We have more data to go from. We have the examples of what worked well in South Korea. We have examples of what worked well in Singapore and in Sweden. We have examples from we have 50 basically laboratories of different scales of economic restriction and social distancing restrictions here in the United States that we can look at. What I wonder is if the situation in Italy, which had all of the necessary risk factors to have a complete sort of meltdown, you have the issues with Chinese immigrants in the northern part of the country. The northern part of the country has a weaker health infrastructure. You have an older population. You have a higher percentage of the population that smokes. You have more people who live in the same house. That example, which forced us to really wake up, and we can talk about China's failures that led to our reaction in a moment, but that example, which may have just been a single pocket that was the worst possible scenario.
Right.
And then here in the United States, what happened in New York. And New York is, again, uniquely positioned to have problems with this. And even they did not even come close to the worst possible projections that we were talking about very early on. You know, the U.S. Navy medical ship is actually leaving New York Harbor this week and going back to Virginia because it wasn't ultimately needed. And so those two situations, which may have just been uniquely sort of primed to become hotbeds for this problem, sort of dictated our policy uniformly.
Right.
And I think that we're going to have to take a very serious look moving forward as to whether or not that was the right choice and whether or not the sort of one size fits all process here in the United States was the right thing to do. Because right now, I would say it's very questionable.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of New York, and we've gone over this before, but I think it bears repeating, as well as Italy. You know, there were certain cultural mitigating factors in Italy. And I talked, the doctor that I talked to earlier this week, Dr. Paul Saladino again, brought this up, that when you have multi-generational people living in the same home, and when you confine them to that home, you end up with young asymptomatic giving it to elderly who are susceptible. Right. And you have an explosion on your hands, and that may have been what drove even more deaths was the quarantine in Italy, sadly.
Absolutely.
And it could be something similar in New York. We're seeing reports about how, I mean, I saw pictures, you know, here's New York completely locked down, but meanwhile, let's go to the subway. And in the subway, it's just like all these people just jam-packed, you know, mask or not, you're going to get it when you get in that situation. So,
right.
So I think, yeah, I mean, I think the evidence is stacking up to show us that, you know, stay 6 feet apart, wear a mask, keep the elderly and the immunocompromised at home throughout, maybe throughout the summer, until we acquire herd immunity for the rest of us who will probably not even be affected by this beyond maybe what would feel like a common cold. That, to me, feels like the right path to go forward. And then everybody's talking about the second wave. I don't know if you've noticed or not, but the media seems to have held us hostage to a very narrow set of parameters that any politician who does open up their state is immediately going to be blamed for every death that happens after that. But there this pivot that's going to this sort of, oh, but the second wave. And I'm like, why are Americans buying into this fear culture? Well, because the media is telling us there's a second wave coming, but we will be prepared for that second wave. If we're not, we're really dumbasses. You know what I mean? But I mean, how can we not be prepared for the second wave? And then it won't be as bad.
Of course. And one of the things that we don't even know is the extent of the first wave, and whether or not the second wave is actually something that we can anticipate. Again, the second wave is sort of based on an assumption about the Spanish flu and the way the Spanish flu worked. And so we have to be really careful not to constrain ourselves to a previous data points. And that's true in our own individual reactions, and that's definitely true in the way that our politicians and our leaders should react to this. But the assumption is that the second wave is going to come and be worse, and it's boosted by the second wave of the Spanish flu, which did come and which was worse.
Yeah.
But there have been a lot of global pandemics since 1918. There have been a lot of very infectious spreading diseases since 1918. And not everyone follows the same pathway as the Spanish flu. We will not truly know the position that we're in related to a second wave or the extent of this wave until, to go back to that original point, we can get the antibody test and ramp up testing overall. We still don't know the actual percentage of people who have had the virus and are asymptomatic or had mild symptoms. Here's another thing that is starting to emerge. We actually aren't really confident anymore of when the first cases came to the United States.
Right.
The New York Times just last night reported that the first death in the United States actually wasn't in Washington, that it was in California. Hmm. And that the earliest cases in the U.S. were actually in January. Now, that completely changes our time frame.
Yes. And our models.
Absolutely. Completely changes the models about what we're dealing with here.
Right.
And so this is another one of those things where every day new data comes out. And what we need more than anything, what I would beg of our leaders, is be adaptable as the data comes out. Be adaptable to the changing situation on the ground. And I think that some leaders are doing that.
Right.
And I think that there are some leaders who are refusing to do that and have surrounded themselves with only one viewpoint. And I really worry about that.
This next topic that I want to hit with you is the fact that a lot of states are about to be out of money. I think there are some governors that are banking on a philosophy of, let me keep my state locked down and enjoy the accolades because everybody's afraid and I look like a king. And then I'll just have the federal government bail me out when I have to declare bankruptcy, because municipalities and state governments, city governments, county governments all across the country rely on things like payroll taxes, income taxes, sales taxes. All that's dried up while we're shut down. So there's really, if things don't open up soon, there's a real threat that common, regular, expected specific important services, vital services, don't go forward in some places. But I think there's one, what I wanted to ask you about was, like, why is it that so many people are buying into this culture of fear and don't seem to realize those economic consequences? And I think it comes down to, and I want to get your thoughts on this, but I think it comes down to, we really legitimately, just like in politics, we have two Americas. We have an America that's getting a paycheck because they can either work from home or they've been furloughed, but they're still getting money, or they're getting more unemployment than they were before. So there's an America that's getting paid and doing quite well as long as they have Netflix. And then there's another America that's not getting paid and is desperate. And that's where this, all this virtue signaling seems to come from, you know, like Hollywood stars and celebrities sitting at home, virtue signaling to the rest of us. Well, it's easy for them when they live in a mansion and everything is delivered to them and they never have to go outside and they got a tennis court and a basketball court and everything they need to entertain themselves. What do you think, what is behind, what is driving this weird, I never thought I would see so many Americans so ready to give up so much liberty because of fear.
I'm there with you, Leland. I mean, there have been aspects of that that have been uniquely discouraging to me over the course of this. And I've really tried hard to wrap my head around it, to try to figure out what exactly motivates it. Because, you know, I've been a conservative my entire life. And so my worldview is oriented towards individual freedom and all of those things. And the best explanation that I can think of is from Thomas Hobbes, which is in Leviathan, in chapter 6 of Leviathan, Thomas Hobbes talks about the fear of violent death, and that what man fears most of all is the effects of the state of nature, which would lead to his violent death, violent and sudden death. And from out of this comes the principle of self-preservation. And so that aspect of human nature, which is very primal, to be afraid of the unknown and be afraid of that which has the power to kill us unexpectedly and suddenly. I mean, you think about the way in which that already governs life for us. Right. If you watch the morning shows, you know, like the Today Show and those sorts of things, like 60% of the segments are just things that scare people.
Right.
You know, it's the entire concept. So I think that that's part of it, that and we saw the same thing after 9/11, that look, the reality is that you and I are probably not going to die from a terrorist attack. It is highly, highly, highly improbable that either of us die from a terrorist attack, but that very primal fear of violent death, which in some way forces us to cooperate, you know, that's the other end of Hobbes's theory, is that because of it, we cooperate in civil society, because through cooperation, we alleviate that risk of violent death. And so, but that aspect of human character governs a great deal. So that's one of the things. But the other thing about just the American perspective overall, and the best way that I've been able to wrap my head around this, is that America has constantly been at tension between our sort of Puritan instincts and the sort of Western frontier mentality. Mm. And both of these things are central to the American identity, that the Puritan instinct, which is to follow rules, to feel guilty, to, you know, to establish a strict framework and all of those things, listen to authority, and the Western frontier mentality that I think you and I tend to think of as being the American identity, or especially central to the American identity, which is in some ways where our whole notion of democracy comes from. The fact that we could set out and make our own fortune, the fact that we could set out and shape the world as we see fit. America has always had a tension between those two aspects of its character. And I think that this is just another instance in which this comes into play, that you see the protesters who I hate the way they have been dismissed by some of the mainstream media, people who are trying to protect their businesses and protect their livelihoods, dismissed as if they are paid to be there by someone, or crazy, or, as you already referenced, don't care about people's lives. So people who say, let us work, we can protect ourselves, we can protect the public, we will practice social distancing, we will follow CDC guidelines, let us operate our businesses, versus those who say, go inside and never come out. Right. And this is just a most recent example of this tension, which has always existed in the country, but that I think that I was a little blind to myself before this, and has certainly been illuminated and in a surprising way somewhat to me over the course of this.
Well, and to tie the two together, going back to your Leviathan reference, along a scale, what is described is the right thing to do. You know, we decided to come together, create a federal government out of that level of, let's just call it fear of maybe an outside invader. And it worked out well for us. When England tried to come back and get us back, we needed that federal government to raise an army to protect the nation. And then when that was done, we could go back to, you know, living our own way, so to speak. And it's a spectrum, right? Like, to a certain extent, we do agree to cooperate because we don't want anarchy. We don't want Mad Max, right? But then it can go too far down that scale, like you said, and that sort of Puritan identity can sort of outweigh the other thought. And then we suddenly just completely shut down and bury our heads in the sand. But I think, to me, what's even more frightening than all of that is the tendency to, it's our new call-out culture. What about the elderly who lost so much of their retirement in a market crash and now can't afford a comfortable, way to live and still be independent in their retirement years, and they'll have to, depend on Medicaid for a nursing home for whatever they get, and so there's that, to me, is like we've gone to this sort of virtue signaling call out. You know, I'm better than you because I stay home. I'm going to call 911 and report you because I don't think you need to really be going to the grocery store. That's the part that concerns me. And I don't know if it's just sort of a beehive mentality, like the more of it that happens, the more of it we get. Like, the more toilet paper is gone, the harder it is to get. I don't know what's right. driving that, And I think it's the Puritan maybe winning out. That scares me a little bit.
You know, there's this scene in 1984 in the book, George Orwell's book, 1984, where one of the things that the book talks about is the kids who would rat out the parents.
Right.
And one of the things that the government did in 1984 was that you weren't assigned your own children, like that you were basically given children to raise that weren't necessarily your own birth children. And part of the reason for that was because then their loyalty was to the government, and that the children would rat out the parents. And I remember reading that and just thinking, no, there's no way, like that's such a radical thing for Orwell to have included, that things like that would never happen. And then you think about, like, the Stanley Milgram experiments in the 1960s at
yes.
Yale University.
Yes.
And the way in which people are – this might sound like a radical thing to say, but I don't care. But the way in which people – in the Milgram experience, 65% of the participants went the full way in shocking the fake victim in those experiments, because they were so – willing to follow orders of any authority. And so, there's a little bit of that here. I mean, staying at home is obviously not on the same scale as the children in 1984 ratting on the parents, or in the people who chose the triple X button to shock the participant in the Milgram experiments. But the underlying adherence to any authority and obedience
right.
is right there in front of us in the same way playing out. And I think rooted in the same sort of primal instincts that I already made reference to.
Wasn't, and please, for those that are listening, I am not in any way, shape or form bringing in the whole Nazi, whatever, right? People always, now we live in a world where politically we accuse the other side of being Nazis or like Hitler or whatever. And that's just, once you've done that, you've lost the argument. But wasn't the book Obedience to Authority that you're talking about, wasn't that to try to understand how in German society they could go from
right.
a functioning society to a society in which people who formerly just cooperated with each other literally oversaw camps that killed people because they were Jewish? Wasn't that to try to find that, why that could happen, where you would have an otherwise person who in another life is a moral, upstanding individual, and somehow gradually they're taken to this place? I mean, it was kind of a warning to that, where obviously I'm not accusing those people that are doing that of being that. But I mean, it shows you how easy it is for human beings to move down this ramp of the slippery slope towards something we never thought we would see in our society.
Correct. I mean, that's right. One of the applications of those experiments was related to the experience of the Nazis, and really what emerged from the Nuremberg trials, which was the excuse that those individuals were following orders.
Yeah.
And that a lot of those individuals gave as defenses that they were simply following orders. And
right.
Again, as we're both saying, no one is saying that calling 311 is on the same scale as the atrocities of the Second World War. But the underlying theory and the underlying sort of takeaways come from the same place, which is obedience to authority and where those things come from.
Yeah. All right. Kentucky could be out of money, according to the Pegasus Institute, one of their latest blogs, to pay unemployment benefits in less than a month. This is an interesting thing because I think part of those two Americas, there are some people that lost their jobs, but they're getting paid more right now to stay at home and watch Netflix than they were working. Because of the bump that was put in by the federal government. It might have been the dumbest way to handle this whole process. You know, the checks I get, I understand. I didn't make these decisions financially. Everybody gets a check. We're going to pay for it. Believe me, you and I will pay it back and then some. But the unemployment probably, and I think it might have been you that said this, but in a discussion that we were having off the air, but I think it was your suggestion that the way that should have been handled was, the money should have gone directly to the businesses as long as they kept those people employed, even if they had to lay them off but continue to pay them, instead of encouraging those businesses to just lay them off and somebody else pay them for the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, that was a discussion that we had. I think in retrospect that the extra $600 that we added onto unemployment was probably the biggest mistake in the Phase 3 stimulus package. I think overall the Phase 3 stimulus package was a good piece of legislation for what it needed to achieve in that particular moment. But it's like with all of these things, we make mistakes and we learn from a policy standpoint what was the right thing to do and what wasn't. And by doing that, not only did we essentially incentivize a lot of businesses from laying off or furloughing their employees, but the flip side is that we're going to incentivize people to stay home and to use the maximum number of weeks available to them for as long as possible.
Right.
And so that is going to be a major, major problem. I mean, people don't think about the monetary side of this, but, you know, there more than half of the states in the country have already used half of their more than 50% of their existing unemployment dollars.
Right.
More than 50% of the states in the country have already used at least 50% of their available unemployment dollars. And we are only 4 weeks into this thing.
Right.
So Kentucky has depleted about 23% of their overall funds in the last 2 weeks alone, and are projected to be out of funds within the next 4 weeks. That we've had nearly 400,000 new claims on the system in the last 4 weeks alone since this really began. We're probably going to add another 100,000, or we'll learn of another 100,000 that have already been added tomorrow morning, whenever those new numbers come out at 8:30, or on Thursday morning when they come out at 8:30. And the one of the things that makes that so tragic is that we depleted the fund in 2008 so we ran out of money completely in 2008. And in January 2009 here in Kentucky, the federal government had to step in like they did in many states during the Great Recession and prop up the system. And then from 2012 onward, we have run surpluses. So it took us some time, obviously, to dig out of the recession and to dig out of the unemployment situation that we were in. But from 2012 until March 2020, we were running surpluses in our unemployment system.
Right.
And so 8 years worth of surpluses into the unemployment fund
gone.
Are going to be erased in less than 2 months.
Okay, does that mean that if we can get back up and going again, that we'll build that back up? Or are you concerned about this being a much longer term? In other words, because this is my concern. My concern is there's a lot of people out there. These are the ones getting paid right now watching Netflix that think when we turn the lights back on, everything goes back the way it was. My thinking is we're in for up to a 10-year rebuild of this economy, that everything is going to be different, that there's going to be massive shifts in how business is done, and that for at least the next couple of years, you'll be lucky to have a job.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think that the hope of what we call a V-shaped recovery, which was in March what we were all talking about, a V-shaped recovery, which means things dip very quickly and then rebound very quickly. I think that all hope of a V-shaped recovery is gone, and that anyone at this juncture who is talking about a V-shaped recovery doesn't understand economics, and you shouldn't even speak to them anymore. The lasting damage to this economy is evident, and it's going to be evident in the employment figures for the rest of the number. For the rest of the year, I'll tell you a couple of the numbers that terrify me. We already know that automobile sales are going to be down at least 15% this calendar year, at least 15% this calendar year. So here in Kentucky, Ford, GM, all of the Toyota, all of the companies which build automobiles in this country are going to have to cut supply to deal with the fact that demand is going to decline by 15%.
Right.
Restaurants, there are about 17 million Americans who are employed in the hospitality industry. Restaurants, the National Restaurant Association said 2 weeks ago that they expect that by May 1st, just around the corner, that by May 1st, that 11% of the restaurants in the whole country will be closed permanently.
Wow.
That they are gone, that they are never coming back, and that they think that based on their survey of their membership, that by the end of the year, that number will grow to 20%.
Wow.
So one in five restaurants in this country are never coming back.
Wow.
Okay. So the true fundamental structural damage to this economy, here's another statistic. The SBA loans, which by many metrics have been a tremendous success. We just posted numbers to Pegasus Institute just posted numbers today that showed that Kentucky got $4 billion worth of SBA loans, which is really, really important. 23,000 businesses in Kentucky which were approved for loans. That's great. Nationally, 1.6 million total businesses were part of the first round of approvals. That sounds like a big number until you realize there are 30 million small businesses in the United States.
Wow.
And so we depleted $300 billion of federal money for 1.67 million small businesses. So 90%, more than 90% of the small businesses in this country have not gotten an SBA loan.
About 5% got an SBA loan, and there's probably 20 to 30 to 40, maybe even 50 that needed it.
Exactly. The deep structural impact on the economy is it will take us. You said a decade. I think that's a good time frame. It'll take us a decade to really deal with the effects of this.
Yeah, and that's all depending on. I don't want to get partisan here, but it's all dependent. For me personally, I'm not a huge like Trump guy. I mean, I support him. You know what I mean? I'm honest. I think he's made a lot of great decisions. Obviously, this would have been a lot harder if the economy wasn't as good as it was. I attribute that to decisions that he and the Republican Congress made heading into this crisis. That being said, honestly, with the choice that we have right now, whether or not this takes 5 years or 15 years depends entirely on whether or not we reelect Donald Trump, and I think who comes after him. Because if the right decisions are not made, this could be Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, extending the Great Depression by 10 years because he did all the wrong things, and it took World War II breaking out for us to really get the American engine running again. And I don't want that to be what gets us out of this.
Oh, you hit the nail on the head, especially with the what made the Great Depression great was not that it was the first economic downturn of its type to ever happen. In the latter part of the 20th century, there were many economic downturns similar to the market collapse of 1929. What made the Great Depression great was the actions of the federal government, and especially the actions of the Federal Reserve, that exacerbated the problems and ruined an entire decade.
Yeah.
And there is no doubt that the exact same thing could happen again.
Yeah.
And that could be the story of the 20s.
Well,
when
we have prominent Democrats out there saying, hey, this is a good opportunity to do the Green New Deal, while oil, you know, was temporarily below $0 a barrel, something we've never seen before and most people didn't even know was possible. And I mean, it's stabilized now, but honestly, you want to talk about a disruption in the industrial chain of events. You know, have people dumping barrels of oil because they can't afford to take them and store them. You know, that is just something I don't think anybody wanted to see. And yet we had Democrats, prominent Democrats, celebrating on what they thought was the grave of oil. And I'm like, this is a dangerous mentality. These people don't understand how the economy works.
I completely agree with every bit of that. And it's, you know, that example, just that single example from the oil market, you know, we don't have to harp on this too much, but American energy independence is literally the most important economic achievement for this country of the last decade.
Yeah.
I mean, this was something that politician after politician, candidate after candidate after candidate promised that they were going to do since the oil embargo of the 1930s. So since Jimmy Carter, politicians have been promising for American oil independence, energy independence, and we achieved it, right, thankfully, because of the people who were willing to, who created the fracking process, and who and the governors who were willing to let it move forward, not the ones like Andrew Cuomo, who blocked it,
right,
who put us in a position for American energy independence, so that when countries like Saudi Arabia say we're going to flood the market, that it doesn't shut down the United States. And I think that there are many politicians in this country who would love to go back to the way things were 10, 12, 15 years ago,
yeah,
when we were dependent on foreign governments, foreign trade routes, foreign commodity markets to determine our price at the pump or how much a plane ticket costs, and all of those other factors that go into or that contribute to the price of a barrel of oil.
Yeah.
And they've shown that over and over the last couple of weeks.
All right, before we move on to China, real quick, kind of on the economic thing, what do you think, okay, like if we talk about how this economy is going to work going forward, what do you think is the best thing once we reopen that President Trump can do to reignite the economy as fast as possible?
You know, early on, I was I did not like the payroll tax cut idea, mm-hmm, or the payroll tax holiday idea. I thought that it was being promoted as a sort of panoply option when I didn't think that it would achieve the same results that we wanted.
Right.
I think that now, post stimulus package, and as we look to try to get people back into the workforce, that the payroll tax cut holiday is a good idea. That what was done in the phase three stimulus bill isn't a true holiday. It's a deferment.
Right.
So there is right now a payroll tax deferment, but you still have to pay those back in 2021 and 2022. So you just get to defer it to those tax years. I think that a holiday is a good idea as long as the federal government makes the same assurance that they did in the phase three stimulus package, which is that it won't impact the Social Security Trust Fund, because we're going to need to encourage employers to rehire. That's one of the things that's going to take place, is that employers are going to, especially with the talk of a second wave, the risk of a second wave, all those things, employers are just naturally going to be slower to bring back their full workforce. And so anything that we can do to encourage employers to bring back the full scale of their workforce, maybe be able to offer higher wages, I think that's a positive thing. I think that a lot of the things that we're going to need to see done will naturally be done by the SBA loans and the other money that the Treasury is currently in the process of doling out that can help stabilize some of the larger corporations, that we're just going to have to get past this, the hump. And by that, I mean, just time is going to have to allow us to get past the the confidence dip and, you know, allow consumer spending to get back to the levels that it needs to be. And that will happen naturally. So that's on one side. One of the other things that the Trump administration can do is some of the barriers that have been broke down as far as red tape goes can be made permanent or can be extended even further. The Department of Transportation, it's sort of flown under the radar, but the Department of Transportation has done a ton of stuff to make life easier for truckers and for cargo carriers and for all of these other industries that are helping us ensure that there is in fact toilet paper on the shelf whenever we go to Target.
Right.
Some of those things can be made permanent from every agency that's done some of those things that can just give businesses confidence that they can get back to the same levels they were before. But, you know, one of the things I don't want to see, and I think the Democrats have started in Congress have started to see this as an endless opportunity for stimulus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is not how we fix that. That's the way to undermine the value of our currency and to turn this place into Zimbabwe in the name of liberal pet projects.
Yeah.
And I love Senator McConnell basically said today that is not going to be the way that the United States Senate moves forward about this, that it's not going to be an endless stream of bailouts for state governments who have made bad decisions. It's not going to be an endless stream of bailouts for every little liberal pet project. And so, frankly, thank goodness that the United States Senate is there to be the saucer that cools, as George Washington said, and prevents some of those bad ideas. But, you know, ultimately, we just need businesses to be able to reopen and to be able to do the things that they do the best. If the government gets out of the way, which remember, this is a government mandated shutdown, there is no other economic system who could withstand this and come out on the other side and be adaptable and entrepreneurial and be able to fix the problems that need to be fixed, to be able to protect the public in the way that they need to be protected, and be able to grow and strengthen the economy on the other side than the free market system. No other system could achieve this.
Yeah.
And so we just need to get the boot off the throat of the free market system and get it off of it in every way possible and let it go.
It's the only thing that'll save us. How in the world did big businesses get some of that Small Business Administration loan money? Have you seen these stories where large businesses were taking a big thing? I think any large business that took that money ought to be shamed until they give every penny back and then some.
Yeah, I've seen the list, but I don't actually know what allowed them to qualify. I don't know what
that loophole needs to be fixed.
Yeah, big time.
Let's talk China, the place where President Trump used to make his ties. I always thought that was funny. I mean, he's consistently against China, but at the same time, he wears these. I've got one. I actually have one in my closet. It's one of my favorite ties. They're actually really good quality ties. But right there on the label, it says "Made in China" or "Made in China," as he would say. What do we do to make them pay for what they've done here?
Yeah, that to me is the absolute most important. I mean, I think it might be the most important geopolitical question of the next two decades, and that what this instance has been, what this coronavirus, what this pandemic has been, has essentially been a turning point moment for the West, for the Western world, in the same way that 9/11 was a turning point moment for the Western world's relationship with the Middle East. Henry Kissinger wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago that basically said that the world order will be reshaped coming out of this. And I think that China is uniquely aware of that fact. Why did the Chinese stop testing their citizens? Why did the Chinese stop reporting the total number of infections? Why have they lied about the number of deaths? We know that they have lied about the number of deaths, in part because they came out last week and acknowledged that there were many more deaths in Wuhan than they originally had said, but also because individuals on the ground pressured the Chinese Communist Party significantly because of the lies about the numbers, about the number of deaths. China is uniquely aware of that coming out of this, they need to be able to make the argument that only their system of government, only their structure was able to properly handle a problem like this and properly handle a pandemic like this.
Oops, I gotta stop it there. When I went to post this entire episode, it was too long to post on my site, and it's forcing me to break it up into two episodes. So the rest of the conversation is in part two. Fortunately, I am actually going to post both of these episodes in the same day, so you don't have to wait like a week to hear the rest of the conversation, because it gets really, really good from here. So thanks for listening, and we will continue with part two as soon as it is uploaded. And if you like what we're doing here, gosh, please share it. It's a free subscription on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, on iHeartRadio's app. Just go to iHeartRadio's app and search The Disruption Zone, and it will deliver me and all my guests right to your pocket. It comes in an email when there's a new episode up. It's a bam, deliver right to you. So hopefully we'll be able to continue this, and the way we continue this is for the audience to continue to grow. And so if you can share it with your friends, let them know that they can subscribe for free. Let them know that it's an awesome podcast and that we're trying to speak for liberty-loving Americans. And we're not going to be all politics. It's had to be COVID and it's had to be politics sometimes lately. But I have grand goals and designs for this podcast to become even much more than politics, to talk to fascinating people from across all realms of life. And we're going to take it in that direction. But for the time being, because this is what America is facing, I'm staying focused on that because I feel like that's my duty as someone with an audience. We need to talk about the things that matter most to you and me, and that's this right now. So anyway, any way that you can share it with your friends is a big help to us. You can follow us on Twitter. It's at Zone Disruption, because some jackwagon stole Zone Disruption Zone. So it's Zone Disruption on Twitter. And of course, I'm Leland Show. And then on Instagram, it's at The Disruption Zone, and I am at Greatly Londo. So we'd love to have you there. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, who will be back with us soon. We got an episode coming out here shortly with him involved. So appreciate him and his help. And also Dynamics Productions, dxaudio.com, if you want to know more. Whether you just want to take a video project, maybe an old VHS tape, and upgrade it to something that can play on your system now, they can do that all the way up to a Hollywood production. He's actually worked on Hollywood productions. Major stars have come into his studio in Lexington and done things for major movies. It's pretty cool stuff. He's one of the best audio engineers in the world, in my opinion. He's the best I know, Neil Kesterson over there. And they provide the music for this program and some production advice as well. So I appreciate them. Thanks again for listening. I am Leland Conway. You're listening to The Disruption Zone.